From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Power to the people, it's a tagline of American democracy. But is our democratic system working? Today we'll ask if democracies are always destined to die.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Democracy simply doesn't work.
We'll let the experts debate that. First, though, we talked politics in the break room on Friday. One woman severed ties with her mother when she found out her mom is a Donald Trump supporter. And we wondered, is there a political issue or candidate that has the potential to divide your family? Here are your first thoughts from Facebook. Ann Raines writes, "Oh, wow. I mean, my mom has been a blasted Democrat for years, and I still love her bunches and refuse to let politics come between us. I only have one mom and refuse to let the loony party she votes for come between us." Katrina James says, "I don't know about dumping them, but surely some folks are meant to be loved from a distance." And Galen Jacob adds this, "I wouldn't disown anyone because of who they support politically, although I will question their sanity if they support Trump." We always love getting your thoughts because they're usually great. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message. We're also on Twitter and we're at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We might feature your comments on the show. Come this December, millions of American workers will be eligible for overtime pay. That's because of a new policy finalized by the Labor Department last week. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of what this policy means in a moment. But first, let's talk about what overtime is. And you know, if there's a term we all say but may not really understand, it's time to break it down.
Ooh, break it down, baby, because I won't y'all all know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Overtime pay is the extra money you get when you work more than 40 hours a week. But have you ever wondered how we came up with 40 hours as the standard work week? Not long ago, there was a viral post going around social media that said, "Unions didn't create the 8-hour day and the 40-hour work week. Henry Ford did." But like so many viral posts, that's not true.
Where'd you hear that?
The internet.
And you believed it?
Yeah. They can't put anything on the internet that isn't true.
Where'd you hear that?
The internet.
The first time we see mention of a mandated 8-hour workday in this country was just after the Civil War. Illinois passed a law that included a small number of workers, but that law wasn't really enforced. At the time, and for decades before that, it wasn't unusual for workers to put in 12, 14, even 16-hour days before they were allowed to go home. The issue of working hours became a national conversation in the late 1880s. It was, in fact, a union that pushed the issue, the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions.
"Well, there was a time before trade unions, when working conditions were dangerous, and when a day's toil was paid for with half a cabbage."
When the group couldn't get lawmakers to mandate the 8-hour workday, and they couldn't get businesses to agree to it, they started staging demonstrations. One protest in Chicago turned into a riot. In May of 1886, a peaceful march was disrupted when someone threw dynamite into the crowd. Dozens of people were injured, and at least 11 were killed, including a number of police officers. It's now known as the Haymarket Affair, and it's the reason people observe May Day, also known as International Workers' Day or Labor Day. May 1st is when the rest of the world celebrates Labor Day. America celebrates it in September, but that's another story. We're talking about working hours and overtime. By the time Henry Ford was desperately seeking more factory workers in 1914, the country had still not adopted the 8-hour workday as a standard. Ford made headlines and recruited a lot of people by promising they would only work 8 hours a day.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
But that did not translate into a 40-hour work week. Why? Because most Ford employees worked 6 days a week. In fact, most people worked on 6 days in the U.S. and picked up their pay packets at noon on Saturday.
"I love these lazy Saturdays."
"It's Wednesday, Homer."
"Work!"
Almost 25 years later, President Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. That law created the minimum wage. It also limited the work week and required that employees pay their workers at least time and a half for any hours exceeding the limit.
Except perhaps for the Social Security Act, it is the most far-reaching program, the most far-sighted program for the benefit of workers that has ever been adopted here or in any other country. Without question, it starts us towards a better standard of living and increases purchasing power to buy the products of farm and of factory.
By 1940, the 40-hour work week was the standard, and overtime, as I'm sure you've guessed, is anything that goes over that limit. But those rules were created to protect blue-collar people. So managers and administrators were exempt. So were some waiters and housekeepers who might work non-standard hours. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, more than 40% of American workers are considered exempt or not eligible for overtime. That includes everyone who makes more than about $24,000 a year. The Department of Labor has proposed making significant changes so that anyone making less than about $47,000 a year is eligible for overtime pay. That would increase the earnings of about 5 million workers.
Pretty good.
Yes, it is. It is
pretty, indeed. pretty good.
But this is just the basic history of overtime pay. For a more nuanced perspective, we need to consult an actual expert. Here to answer some common questions about the new Labor Department policy is Wall Street Journal reporter Melanie Trotman. She joins me from Washington, D.C. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, good morning.
So the first question is, will this actually happen? And I ask that because there is a presidential election occurring before this policy is meant to take place. What if Donald Trump is elected?
Well, the rule goes into effect December 1st, so it will happen.
Regardless of what president is in office?
Yes, it will go into effect. And, you know, now any rule can be repealed in Congress. So what would happen in the months after that? I don't know. But the rule will go into effect on December 1st of this year.
Okay, here's a common question. What about teachers?
Teachers, you know, there are a few professions that are just absolutely exempt from this regulation, and teachers are one of them.
And does that mean all teachers, including college professors?
It does. College professors, they are exempt from this regulation. They do not qualify for overtime pay, regardless of their salary, regardless of their circumstances.
What and lawyers is another one. What are the other exempt professions?
Lawyers and also doctors.
Okay. So here, one of the very first questions that I saw, especially when journalists were listening to it, because journalists often work long hours, as you know,
yes.
is what if your office just expects you not to report those overtime hours? What is a worker to do then?
Well, you know, I mean, employers are supposed to follow the law, and they are supposed to get an accurate account of the employee's time worked. And so if an employee has a grievance, I mean, you know, employees can file grievances with the Labor Department. I mean, I guess they could start with their HR department. Or go to a manager and discuss their issue. But if that didn't work, then, I mean, they can go to the government and complain.
Do we have an accurate count on how many people this will affect?
So it's supposed to affect, it will make 4.2 million Americans newly eligible for overtime pay. Now, the administration also expects that millions more will start getting overtime pay because it estimates that there are millions of people who are currently eligible but aren't getting the pay. And the reason is that there's a lot of confusion. It can be very confusing to determine who is and who isn't eligible for this pay because there's something called the duties test. And the duties test, it just means that you have certain duties that make you exempt from the overtime pay requirement, right? And so, but that test can be confusing, and the administration said by raising the threshold, sort of the cutoff point, right, at which people are automatically eligible for overtime, by doing that, it's going to make clear to all these people kind of in a gray, seemingly gray area that they too qualify for overtime pay.
Okay, so what is the purpose of this rule change? Is this basically the Obama administration trying to address rising income inequality?
Absolutely. I mean, Vice President Joe Biden was very clear with reporters when he spoke to us about this last week. He said this gets at the heart of a defining issue of our time, and that is expanding and strengthening the middle class. He said that, you know, what has happened is that over time, now this reg was last updated in 2004. And so the current threshold or cutoff point is $23,660, right? That means anybody who, all hourly employees generally qualify for overtime pay.
Yeah.
But salaried workers who make less than that automatically qualify. But many who make more than that don't. And so what they did, first of all, they said that inflation had eroded that $23,660 level over time, right? It's been 12 years since this was updated. And so they're increasing it to about $47,000. And that's why they're doing it, so that more people will fall under that threshold automatically and qualify for overtime pay.
We got a tweet from T-Barf who says CPAs and accountants are generally exempt, but not bookkeepers. Some may say the purpose is to gut white-collar jobs and mobility, just like he, and I assume he means Obama, has for hourly jobs. What do you make of that comment?
Well, I mean, he is not alone in that point of view. The business community, a lot of employers, a lot of business trade groups have the same opinion. No one said that the thresholds shouldn't be increased. Everyone said, you know, it's time to increase it. But they did say this is too high. They think the level's too high, the 47,000 level. They also feel that it's going to have some negative effects on the economy. Employers, I've talked to employers that say they might slow hiring. They're going to reduce workers' hours. They might have to cut pay and bonuses and benefits to comply with this rule.
Now, Melanie, this is what confuses me, because mm-hmm. CEO pay has risen almost 1,000% since 1978. That's almost double the stock market growth, and that's 90 times faster than pay for average worker. So while businesses are saying we can't afford this, why don't they just reduce CEO pay, which would also affect mm-hmm. income inequality?
Yeah, well, that is the point of the left, you know, unions and worker advocacy groups. So, you know, the businesses that I'm hearing from most are actually smaller businesses.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't really have CEOs necessarily. And they're saying, look, I'm a small business owner. I'm not rich. I try to treat my workers well. I'm going to follow the law, but that means that I'm going to restrict overtime at my Burger King franchise restaurant. My people, they're not gonna be able to work more than 40 hours a week. Or I'm gonna hire more part-time workers. Or I'm gonna scale back the hours of the workers I have. Or I'm not gonna hire as many people. I'm just gonna make do with what I have. And you know, there's a concern too that like managers might have to take on more work, or part-time workers might have
to take on.
Since
they're still exempt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's
that is Wall Street Journal reporter Melanie Trautman. Melanie, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This is On Second Thought. Donald Trump is winning the evangelical vote by big numbers, but a poll from the firm The Barna Group shows there's a big split between those who regularly go to church and those who don't. Joining me now to discuss this political divide among Christians is Riggins Earle. He's a professor of ethics and theology at the Interdenominational Theological Center of the Atlanta University Center. It's good to have you, Riggins.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Mike Griffin joins us as well. He's the public affairs representative for the Georgia Baptist Mission Board, and he also serves as senior pastor for Liberty Baptist Church in Hartwell, and he joins us via Skype. Hi there, Mike.
Hey, great to be with you all today.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Mike.
So,
good morning.
In Georgia, the number one reported faith is white evangelical Protestant. Number two is black Protestant. When we're talking about evangelicals politically, Riggins, are we talking about white evangelicals?
Yes, I think we're talking about both. However, a lot of blacks don't see themselves, don't give themselves that label of being even evangelical.
They don't call themselves evangelical, white Protestants do.
I think it would be safe to say that, yes.
Mike, I want to play you this clip from Russell Moore with the Southern Baptist Convention. He announced in March that he has stopped calling himself an evangelical because he doesn't want to be associated with Trump supporters. Here he is speaking with NPR.
At least in the Bible Belt, someone may claim to be an evangelical who's drunk right now and who hasn't been to church since someone took him to vacation Bible school back in the 1980s. And so that's not a useful category. What's useful is finding out whether or not people are actively following Christ, whether they're church attenders, for instance.
And so this is where this poll from the Barna Group kind of steps in, because there does seem to be a divide between those who regularly attend church and those who don't. What do you make of that?
Well, when we think of Christianity in general and what evangelicalism usually is a reference to, is that somebody that, you know, that believes in the sole authority of Scripture. They believe that someone must have a personal encounter with Jesus Christ and must trust Him as a personal Lord and Savior, the exclusivity of Christ, the belief in absolute morality. But, you know, there's definitely a trend where you have people that would associate with what we would call a cultural Christianity, which, you know, would not be considered to be true biblical Christianity. That would be just people that go to church or associate from a cultural standpoint with Christianity in general. But those that are very serious about following Christ would be those that would be involved in church. You know, they would be a disciple. There would be something about their life that would be more than making a profession. You know, Jesus talked about those that profess one thing and do another. You know, you say, yeah. He'll say one day to them, "Depart from me, I never knew you." So, you know, what people say and what they do sometimes is definitely a disconnect. I think you can see that here. And it depends on your definition of evangelical. What do you mean by that? I think it's pretty broad. And I think that's why you're seeing a large support for Trump.
Okay. So, and now I'm not an evangelical. I've never been an evangelical. So part of this is an education for me, as I assume, along with a number of our listeners. But here's the thing. Donald Trump said he's a faithful Presbyterian and member of a church in Manhattan, but the congregation that he said he's a member of released a statement saying he's not an active member. He also said, when they asked him about his religious practices, "When we go in church and I drink the little wine, which is about the only wine I drink, and I eat the little cracker, I guess that's a form of asking forgiveness." And here's another thing that he said at last year's Iowa Family Leadership Summit.
"Have you ever asked God for forgiveness?" "I'm not sure I have. I just go and try and do a better job from there. I don't think so. I think if I do something wrong, I think I just try and make it right. I don't bring God into that picture. I don't."
Riggins, "I don't bring God into that picture." How does that jibe with what we know about evangelical beliefs?
You know, and that's a, you could look at that several ways, at least two ways, I think. One is African Americans coming up in the South, at least, have, could probably hear that in one way. It sounds very sensible. One is that we have come up in a culture that where it has been cultural Christianity, and where people could go to church and be pious and all of those good things and reject you on the basis of the color of your skin or some other prejudice that they had against you, or lynch you and in Jesus' name. So that has been, I would hear that as one who has studied Southern culture and American culture as being a sobering kind of response. I think there are African Americans who are part of the very Bible Belt who would say, "Okay, that's not my," and they're Christians, "but that's not my main concern whether you are, you know, all pious before God. My main concern is that you bring justice and fairness into a social order that leaves hundreds of thousands of people homeless, leaves them without jobs, leave them below the poverty line because they have to work jobs that don't pay decent wages, et cetera, et cetera."
Okay, so let me bring this back to you then, Mike. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Riggins Earle, a professor of ethics and theology at the Interdenominational Theological Center, and Mike Griffin, senior pastor at Liberty Baptist Church in Hartwell. Let me play you a comment, Mike, from Kelly Sanderson of Villarica, Georgia. She's a Christian, does not regularly attend church.
I do not think Trump exemplifies Christian values. He's way too hateful. He likes throwing stones at people, you know, with words. He talks down to people. The whole building a wall thing only proves that he doesn't believe in making, you know, people feel loved and equal. And I really think, you know, Christianity is supposed to be about helping people. And I don't think he helps people at all. I don't think he wants to either.
I think what is confusing people, Mike, is the things that have mattered to evangelicals in the past. For example, evangelicals really went after John Kerry for flip-flopping, and that's something that Donald Trump has changed his opinion on. 62% of evangelicals support finding a way to allow unauthorized immigrants to stay in the U.S. That's kind of, I think, what's confusing people is a surprise at support for a guy that's now been married three times.
Well, if you're going to take these same moral standards and place them on Hillary Clinton, she's going to come up short as well. And here's the point we need to look at today. You start out in a Republican primary with 17 candidates, I believe, running. Okay, so that was pretty broad. Donald Trump came out talking about being anti-establishment. He wanted to shake up the system. Folks were identifying with that. They were not getting down into the weeds of everything he's ever said or done. And to be quite honest with you, working 9 years at the Capitol as a lobbyist, you wouldn't want to get in on the weeds of a lot of people that call themselves Christians and evangelicals when you get down to really how they live and what they do. I hate to say that, but there's always been those people that say one thing and do another, and I understand that's into politics. But now you're down, you're getting away from the primaries. You're down to basically what's going to end up being two choices. And so in the primary, a Christian, a Bible-believing Christian, which to me, it's hard to be a Christian and not believe the Bible. It's hard to be a Christian and not be born again. But for terms of our conversation, a Bible-believing Christian, I think, would take what they believe about the character of Christ and the Scriptures in the primary and try to find the person that best matches that belief system, that biblical worldview. And then by the time you get to the primary, you may be saying, like probably some Christians, he, you know, wasn't my first choice. He's probably my last choice. But now he may be my only choice, and I think that comes down to Supreme Court.
All right. Picks. Then, Riggins, we have just like a minute and a half left, and I want to play this comment from Albert Mueller. He's president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Again, he's speaking to NPR, and he's saying maybe it's time to officially, in official counts, redefine what an evangelical is.
We have taken comfort in the fact that there have been millions and millions of us in America, and a part of that evidence has been the last several election cycles with the evangelical vote being in the millions, and now we're having to face the fact that evidently theologically defined by commitment to core evangelical values, there aren't so many millions of us as we thought.
Is he correct there that this is a time to do a recount?
Yeah, I think it should have been done a long time ago, if you ask me. But I think he is right. Yes, I think you said we had a minute left.
Yeah. Okay, Riggins Earle. He's professor of ethics and theology at the Interdenominational Theological Center of the Atlanta University Center. And Mike Griffin is senior pastor at Liberty Baptist Church in Hartwell and public affairs representative for the Georgia Baptist Mission Board. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much. Joy to be on.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Centuries ago, Plato predicted that democracy is always doomed to fail and die eventually. Plato said a tyrant will always rise in democracies and end the free system. Was he right? We have Charlotte Thomas with us to answer that question. She teaches philosophy at Mercer University in Macon. Right now, though, she's in Athens, Greece, where she joins us by Skype. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, how are you, Celeste?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. I hear the birds tweeting. What time is it there in Athens?
It's about 4:30 in the afternoon.
Lovely.
Beautiful blue sky.
Okay, well then let's talk about depressing things instead of beautiful blue skies.
All right.
Now, Plato predicted this a long time ago, but at the time he was pretty angry with democracy because it killed Socrates, his mentor. So how are we to take Plato's prediction?
Well, I mean, Plato presents the cycle of regimes and the decay of regimes in Book 8 of the Republic. And as you said, he is pretty angry about the death of Socrates, the trial and death of Socrates. But it is difficult to figure out exactly what Plato thought about democracy, because in other dialogues, like the Apology, he seems to say that democracy is the place least likely to kill a philosopher. So it's even more depressing than it sounds. It's not just democracy that's the danger. A democracy might be the best case for a philosopher and still they're in danger.
Okay.
So
he said that democracy, and he had five stages of democracy, but the death of democracy was what, number four? And number five was tyranny, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in Book 8 of the Republic, you have the best case scenario is monarchy or aristocracy, and then it devolves into timocracy, which is the rule by those who value honor, which will necessarily devolve into oligarchy, those who value money most. Then below that is democracy. And democracy, he says, is this dappled, many-color regime. It doesn't have a clear focus. That's what makes it democratic, is that people with different interests take power at different moments, and it's unstable because of that. But it's also beautiful, and it's where there's more diversity. But the problem is that in that context, a tyrant can rise up. Someone who is can speak well or is charismatic for various reasons can capture the imagination of people within a democratic regime and seize power and become a tyrant. So if Plato's cycle is to be taken literally, which Roman philosophers like Polybius, for example, absolutely did, then yeah, whenever you have a regime that lends itself to free speech, to popular sovereignty, then you risk having somebody charismatic rise up who will take advantage of that situation, and tyranny is born from that.
Now, we should remember that the democracy of Athens was about 800 years old or so at the time when he wrote this. Ours is only 240 years old. Is it possible we're still in the oligarchy stage? are we still have a few hundred years left?
Oh, well, you know, first of all, it's really important to remember that we don't have a pure democracy. And in fact, this is how the cycle of regimes really became influential in the history of political thought, is that if you see this cycle, if you see that one regime type is going to devolve into another, the challenge is either to slow that down or to disrupt the cycle completely. And the way that you do that is to not have a pure regime, to design a mixed regime, a regime that has some sort of balanced cocktail of the different parts, the different types of regimes put together in a way that's balanced and won't fall apart. So the American founders in particular knew this history, knew this political theory, and what they designed is not a pure democracy. So for example, the Senate seems to have this sort of, you know, two votes per state. This something that kind of like, it's certainly not straightforwardly like an aristocracy, but something like that. Whereas the House and more populist vote is something like a democracy. And so between the two, you have some balance. Of course, you also have balance between the different branches of government. And so, how much time do we have?
We got about 30 seconds here.
Okay, but we have a mixed regime, not a pure democracy, so we're not necessarily subject to that, to Plato's cycle.
Which you take some optimism from. We are going to continue to talk about this, and I'm going to test that as the cynical journalist that I am. I'm speaking with Charlotte Thomas. She teaches philosophy at Mercer University. She is joining us from Athens, Greece. Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Ancient philosophers predicted serious flaws in the democratic model of government. And even today, there are still questions about whether our democracy can survive. With me now to talk about the state of American democracy is Michael Evans of Georgia State University. He teaches political science. That would not be an improvement.
I think sometimes my students wish it was political silence. But no.
When you hear a lot of debates in Congress, sometimes I think that too. And also with us is political science professor Robert Pirro of Georgia Southern University. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thank you.
Okay, so part of the impetus for this conversation has been the discussion among some thinkers around the country into what it means, this nominating process for president that we're seeing. I want to play a comment from Andrew Sullivan. He's a conservative. He wrote a New York Magazine story called America Has Never Been So Ripe for Tyranny. And he lays out the case that we have too much democracy, and that's what's killing democracy. Here he is speaking with Slate Magazine's Trump Cast podcast.
The idea of sharing power or being checked by other branches of government or even checked by the press seems anathema to him. And I think when you have someone with that kind of temperament walking into our constitutional system, you are kind of setting yourself up for a constitutional crisis.
What do you make of the constitutional crisis that he says we're in? Do you think that's accurate?
Well, for the question of whether our democracy is about to die and whether whether Trump presents the real threat of a tyrant like Plato had in mind, I think is very far fetched. I think that. You know, for you have to think through what would it take for any candidate, for any president to present a true threat of an authoritarian takeover of our government. And here you have to look at the institutional framework, the fact that we have the separation of powers, the fact that we have civilian control of the military and a military that is indoctrinated into a strong respect for the rule of law and democracy and for the Constitution. I think that someone who has authoritarian tendencies and who embraces political violence the way that Donald Trump does, I think that they can be very damaging. I think that they are antithetical to a lot of our highest democratic ideals. But I don't think that they present a threat to the continuance of our democracy.
Yeah, that's a little different than a constitutional crisis. Robert, let me play you this comment from Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. He was speaking on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and he's talking about both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders here.
Trump and Sanders are the same guy because they both tap into anger, the anger of the voter who feels they're getting hosed. The good part about it is it gets people engaged in a political process. Uh-huh. So that's good. What's bad is both Trump and Sanders say stuff that's impossible. That could never happen. And their followers, I guess, don't really care.
When was the last time the world saw a democracy usurped by tyranny, Robert? Was it Germany? When was it?
Well, Germany is probably the most prominent example that one can think of in the recent past. But I'd like to go back to that comment by O'Reilly. And I think it's important to make a distinction between Trump and Sanders. I mean, when you think about the threats to democracy, there are at least two that come to mind immediately, and that's factionalism. And what I mean by that is that when groups in society are unwilling to tolerate sharing power with others. And I think that Trump really is a kind of standard bearer for that threat, that he and I think some of his followers anyway are intolerant of sort of limits. And so that's the threat he poses. Now, with Sanders, I think he's actually putting his finger on the other red flag, I think, the other threat to democracy, which is corruption, which is public officials using their power for private gain. And I think that Sanders is not—he's not a corrupt person, but he's sort of putting his finger on that threat to democracy. So I see it. I would say that in this election cycle, we see two red flags out there for the threats to democracy. One is factionalism, which Trump, I think, he exemplifies, and the other one is corruption, which Bernie Sanders is doing his best to sort of put a spotlight on.
Mike, those are factionalism and corruption, especially when it's tied to money, are two things that Plato pointed out as red flags to the death of democracy. And we just heard Charlotte explain that we do not live in a pure democratic system. Right. We certainly have touches.
Absolutely.
We're a capitalist democracy, but we have touches of socialism and all kind of other isms. But Do you still accept those kind of things as red flags, even in our modern American democracy?
Yeah, for having a healthy democracy that you know that's functional and lives up to for us to live up to our full potential as a constitutional democracy that respects human rights and the rule of law, absolutely corruption and factionalism are a problem. I think you know I would say that our partisan polarization that we have today is an example of the problem of factionalism as well as...
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because let me play this comment from Paul Ryan. He's a Republican Speaker of the House, and he says he doesn't think democracy works with a two-party system in the executive and legislative branch. Here he is speaking with Fox News host Megyn Kelly.
We're going to offer specific plans. We're going to say, here is what we could do with a Republican president in 2017.
To try to get the
voters
motivated.
If you elect us, this is what we'll do. Because the key is we have to have the people break this tie. We have this divided government, liberal president, conservative Congress. It's not working.
So you don't think anything could get done unless it's one-party rule?
Look at the path we are on.
So how do you put that into context, Robert?
Well, I think I would go back to the comment that Dr. Evans just made, and that is this partisan sort of polarization. But I think really historically, if you look at it, what's happened is that and I think that there's plenty of evidence of this, that the Republican Party's moved more to the right, and the Democrats have moved more to the center as they've been pulled in that direction. And once again, I think the idea that the only way we can get things done is by having unitary party rule, I mean, that makes me a little uncomfortable. I think that, you know, in the past we've had presidents from one party and Congresses controlled by the other, and there's been cooperation. And what's happened today is that, you know, for many people, that's no longer a possibility. And that's definitely worrisome for people who believe in democracy.
Now, Mike, is it possible that if our democracy is weak or threatened at this point, is it possible that's because of apathy? I mean, among the developed nation, I think we have almost the lowest amount of voter participation of any developed world. Is it because people simply aren't participating?
Lack of participation. It's not all due to apathy. A lot of it has to do with our registration laws and the rules governing the game that make it harder to vote in this country than in other countries. So I don't equate low turnout with apathy necessarily. Although there is a lot of that, there's also widespread ignorance by citizens, and we don't want to say that, but it's true. The opinion polls, 50 years of political science research have borne it out. There is a disturbingly high level of ignorance and disengagement. So I think, you know, we definitely, anytime you're talking about the prospects for democracy, you must look at civic education, and it's probably our...
Most schools don't have civics anymore.
One of the most worrisome developments. I think that we need to reinvigorate our civic education in this country. Absolutely.
All right. My guests are Michael Evans of Georgia State University and Robert Pirro of Georgia Southern University, both to teach political science. So let me bring you another comment from conservative commentator Andrew Sullivan. He wrote the piece in New York Magazine called America Has Never Been So Ripe for Tyranny. He says that Trump's candidacy is not the only reason he's worried about a shift away from democracy. Here he is again speaking with Slate Magazine's TrumpCast podcast.
I think there's also an element in the culture in which Washington is viewed as entirely broken, and therefore they want to blow it up and use this guy to blow it up and then to do whatever he wants. And so I think that at the root of this is a very un-American desire to abolish self-government.
Robert, un-American desire, and I feel like this kind of gets back to what Mike was just talking about, because it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that the more government doesn't work, the less likely people are to feel motivated to vote, which makes government work less efficiently, right?
Well, I think the problem, the Bernie Sanders campaign, he's tried to, I think, spotlight this, is that when people don't feel as though they have a stake in the system, when they feel as though, and this is from the campaign, when the system economically and politically is rigged against them, that's where you get the frustration. And so Sanders argues that a lot of the Trump voters, it's not as though they want to overthrow democracy, but they're frustrated. They're working longer for less pay and so on and so forth. And so they're frustrated by the fact that they don't feel they have a stake and that the system is not working for them. And so that they're willing to, you know, they're willing to listen to somebody who promises, you know, huge walls on the border and closing off immigration from Muslims, you know, just crazy, crazy ideas. But because they're so frustrated with the system, that appeals to them.
All right. Let me play you another clip. And again, we're talking about whether or not democracy is doomed from the start to fail, as Plato suggested. And we're talking about political divisiveness. So that makes this next bit of tape kind of relevant. Last week, Congress erupted. There was an amendment that would have given protection for members of the LGBT community. That amendment failed. The Hill newspaper said that it was supposed to pass. They thought it would pass. But Republican leaders urged their members to change their votes. And if you'll hear here, the lawmakers begin chanting, shame. So, Michael, is this kind of divisiveness in Congress a good sign? I mean, maybe this shows that people are passionate, or is this one of the red flags that Plato told us to watch for?
I think sometimes we need to distinguish between our crisis of governance and the crisis of our democracy. You know, in some ways, democracy is about passion and about standing up for beliefs and standing up for our ideological commitments. And so in some ways, as Andrew Sullivan says, this is a sign of a lot of democracy in our system. But that doesn't necessarily make for workable government, particularly with our institutions. Our institutions are, we have the separation of powers. We have a bicameral legislature. We have a system of fragmented institutions that were designed to force deliberation and compromise and bargaining in order to enact laws. And when you have polarized political parties with very homogeneous ideological commitments, it makes it very difficult for us to govern. And this does also, I think, creates conditions when people, I think, we see disaffection with our system of government, particularly by young Americans at a higher level than older Americans. And I think, you know, they've grown up during this economic crisis and they've seen a government that's unable, incapable of taking action. And that's a disturbing sign that they will believe that this kind of inability for our parties to come together and compromise in the way that we need them to is a sign with a problem with democracy, and that would make me worry.
Okay, so then Robert, look, I know that people often immediately jump to the Hitler comparisons, and to a certain extent, I feel like that's understandable, because obviously people would be afraid of that. The world watched a democracy fall into fascism, and it's in some way healthy to be afraid of that and want that not to happen again. But what do you make of Andrew Sullivan's core theory that at this point there are so many cracks in the wall that we could be in danger of the rise of a tyrant?
Well, I have a close friend who's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and he's been very concerned by the fact that one of the debates Trump said that were he commander in chief and he were to order the military to do something that was unconstitutional, he would expect them to follow his order. I think he later walked that back, but I can understand why Trump, for many people, is a frightening Trump presidency is a frightening prospect. But I have a little more. Maybe I'm a little more optimistic. I mean, Dr. Evans was talking about the possibility that young people might be turned off to politics, might see all this anger as a problem with democracy rather than governance. But once again, if you look at this last campaign and you look at the Bernie Sanders campaign and the young people that he's brought out, people who want to be engaged, who have a positive agenda, I think that there are signs of renewal possibly there as well.
And yet, speaking on the Democrat side, Michael, there many young people are disenchanted by the Democratic process, that they feel Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, contest is not being played out fairly. So is there another bit of a yellow warning sign there?
I suspect they're going to come around. I think they feel like the Democratic Party's nomination process, they feel,
is unfair.
I think that, after June after the last primary, June 6th, is it? Sanders is probably going to realize that he needs to bring the party together, and I think he'll get his supporters regardless of what they think about the process. I think he'll bring them on board to be supportive of democracy in the general election. So I'm not too worried about that over the long term.
Okay, so in the 30 seconds that we have left, Michael Evans of Georgia State University, the state of our democracy is?
Sick, but not on its deathbed.
Robert Pirro of Georgia Southern, the state of our democracy is?
It's under pressure, as democracies are time and again, but I think it has the resources to overcome this.
Okay. I guess that's a little bit of cautious optimism from our two political scientists. Michael Evans teaches at Georgia State University. Robert Pirro teaches at Georgia Southern. They both teach political science. Michael and Robert, thank you both so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on.
That's our show for today, but we would love to get your voices on this as well. What do you think of the state of our democracy and the democratic process here in the U.S.? Are you worried? Are you afraid? And what are you afraid of? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also read us on the Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.